Felix Pinnell is brought to us by the King County Library System. There are three big earthquakes in living memory for a lot of people who spent their whole lives in the Puget Sound area. Those were 2001, 1965, and way back in 1949. But there's a fourth tremor that nobody really remembers anymore. And it happened 80 years ago this week. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this was the November 12th, 1939 quake. I stumbled across a reference to it in some newspaper archives. It hit very late on a Sunday night, about 11:47 p.m., so most people were home and many were in bed, but almost nobody slept through it. Estimates are that it was about a magnitude 6.2, and it shook for maybe 20 or 30 seconds. It was pretty deep, which means it didn't do any serious damage, and the epicenter was probably to the northwest of the Nisqually quake. Now, Bill Steele is the director of communications and outreach for the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network at the University of Washington. He says what some call the Olympic earthquake or the Puget Sound earthquake was felt statewide and beyond.
Felt reports came in from all across western Washington, from, you know, actually down into Oregon, Salem, McMinnville, Portland, all, and all the way up to Blaine and as far east as just west of Spokane. So it really covered a very wide area.
Yeah, unfortunately, damage was pretty minimal and there were no deaths or serious injuries, but the Olympic quake did make its mark.
Auburn, Brooklyn, Centralia, Alma, Oakville, Olympia, and Tacoma got intensity 7. And that's where you expect to start seeing some damage. And indeed, there were, you know, pendulum clocks were stopped and cracked plaster and some damaged chimneys fell. There was some damage in that region. But the rest of the state, and including Seattle, was more intensity 6 and intensity 5.
Yeah, and for those keeping score at home, those intensity numbers are from the modified Mercalli intensity scale. It's not the magnitude of the Richter scale. It's how the earthquake's experienced by those human beings, or whether they're woken up or, you know, knocked down or whatever. For the reference, the Nisqually quake was 6.8 magnitude and intensity 8. I mean, that's why we saw so much damage 18 years ago. Now, I found a list of damage reports from all over Washington and Oregon compiled as part of a unique survey. And those pendulum clocks that Bill mentioned must have been very popular in 1939 because they were stopped in nearly every town, some on north-facing walls, some on west-facing walls, depending on which direction the earthquake was coming from. And there was definitely cracked plaster and damaged chimneys all over the place. Now, my favorite report from Wolotchet Bay down by Gig Harbor, quote, cattle frightened and pheasants crowed. I don't know if there's still cattle or pheasants.
I did not know pheasants could crow.
I know. It takes a special occasion. And though it was almost midnight on a Sunday, this was the modern age, and not everybody was tucked in for the night.
There was kind of a bit of a panic as people raced out of movie theaters, and some folks almost got trampled. There were some injuries when people were trying to leave movie theaters, apparently. So there was a little bit of panic in some areas, both in Olympia and in Seattle.
And one of the movies that people stormed out of was Mr. Smith Goes to Washington from the Liberty Theater down on First and Pike. Now, I also found some clippings from downtown hotels that showed the fry in the Olympic, where panicked guests came down to the lobby in their pajamas and robes, and the desk clerk served hot coffee to calm everyone's nerves. Now, as memorable as those four quakes between 39 and 2000 were, none is considered the big one.
Every 20 years or so on average, we've had a magnitude 6 or greater earthquake, deep earthquake. But we haven't had the big crustal one that really knocks buildings down. That will be in our future sometime, hopefully not soon. But we need to prepare for those as well.
You know, and one thing Bill Steele said really hit me hard. He said there's no seismic retrofit ordinance in Seattle beyond that that forces building owners to secure parapets or things that could fall into the street. And maybe this isn't news to anybody, but the heart of Seattle, you know, in neighborhoods like Pioneer Square, Ballard, and Georgetown, any place where there are concentrations of buildings made of what they called unreinforced masonry, or URMs, those places will be devastated or wiped out by the big one, you know, a shallow crustal quake like the one that hit Christchurch, New Zealand back in 2011. Bill Steele says retrofitting those old buildings, those URMs, doesn't really pencil out.
Because it requires a lot of investment. And most of the buildings will be red tagged after the earthquake anyway, so they have to be torn down. So for the building owner, there's no economic incentive really to retrofit the building. It's a huge investment, and the return can be measured, I think, in saving lives, perhaps, and averting injuries, but they probably aren't going to get their money back out of it is the way they look at it, or maybe they will, I don't know, but I think it's an economic problem.
Yeah, so after the big one, there will be injuries and to treat and deaths to mourn, and, you know, plenty of transportation and infrastructure problems to address. But add to that what could be considered the heart and soul of the old city being wiped out, and that's just really hard to fathom. But it will happen. All those neighborhoods will be very different because those buildings will be either damaged beyond repair and then have to be demolished. So,
yeah,
pretty bizarre.
I don't know what you do about it. I know the newspapers like to scare us every 6 months with predictions of the big earthquake, but there's not. I mean, what are we supposed to do?
Well, keep shoes under your bed. That's the main thing, because most people get injured walking from their bed outside and stepping on broken glass. So keep a good, at the very least, put a pair, good pair of shoes under your bed. You know, on a lighter note, this station was on the air during that quake. And we had a guy named Alan Botzer who stayed on the air and reassured our listeners that the world wasn't coming to an end. And he went on to an illustrious career. He served in the South Pacific and the Armed Forces Radio Network, and then was an announcer for almost 40 years at KNX in Los Angeles. But we were the place to turn to even during the big quake 80 years ago.
How about that? All I can think of is to equip your homes with airbags. So if there's a significant enough jolt, you know, it just it inflates around you, and then you can escape. But otherwise, I don't know what you do.
Yep.
Thank you, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
We know what the Democratic strategy is on impeachment. They will be kicking off the hearings with the witnesses who seem to give the most damning evidence during the depositions that the president was clearly withholding Ukraine's aid package until he got a public promise that Ukraine would investigate the 2016 election and Joe Biden's son, Hunter, who had a paid position with a Ukrainian gas company. The Republican strategy will be to say there is nothing out of line here because the president makes foreign policy.
This is the swamp fighting back.
The swamp fighting back. Republican Mark Meadows of North Carolina was on Steve Bannon's impeachment podcast, which is a daily thing now, saying that what we'll be hearing today are longtime State Department officials who simply disagree with the president's foreign policy. Meadows thinks that we've been suckers when it comes to helping nations like Ukraine.
You're talking about the State Department. Here's what they believe. If you're just nice to people long enough and you give them millions or billions of dollars, that eventually they may think like you do and they're not going to be your enemy. That hasn't worked for decades.
That's what Trump. That's why Trump's president of the United States.
And it drives him crazy. You know that. I know that. I mean, when we start to look at all of this, it is critical that we stop sending American taxpayer dollars overseas for reasons that provide no benefit to the American people.
He's representing the view that we get no benefit out of sending military aid to a country like Ukraine. And as for today's witnesses, who include Ambassador William Taylor and Deputy Assistant Secretary of State George Kent, as impressive as their resumes may be, Representative Meadows says that they have no real evidence of wrongdoing.
None of the witnesses, I want to emphasize that, not a single witness that comes forward had a conversation with the President of the United States. Everything that they based this on is based on somebody else's inference or belief on what the President may or may not have thought.
And that will be one of the main talking points from the Republican side. Here is Republican strategist Jason Miller, who is also on yesterday's podcast, and he has got all the talking points mapped out.
So we boiled it down to 3 points. The number one, President Trump did nothing wrong. Number two, this is a fight about foreign policy. This is the unelected bureaucrats who believe they've been here before President Trump. They're going to be here after President Trump. And gosh darn it, their policy is going to win out, not the duly elected president of the United States. And then third, the fact that Pelosi and Schiff have been running this complete unconstitutional sham process, not giving the president any due process, and ram it. So it's a basic notion of unfairness.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross. It looks like that lawsuit by the Sandy Hook families against the Remington Company for even selling AR-15s, like the one that was used at Sandy Hook, will be allowed to go ahead by the U.S. Supreme Court. Let's talk with Dave Workman, who is the senior editor at thegunmag.com. So what does current law say about the ability to sue an arms manufacturer?
Well, the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act was adopted back in 2005 under the Bush administration. This was a federal statute designed to prohibit what the firearms industry calls junk lawsuits, which were almost uniformly thrown out at some point, and cost the firearms industry a lot of money. They were harassment lawsuits because they really didn't have a lot of basis, and the risk with some of these cases is that if the public, if people are allowed to sue, say, gun manufacturers for crimes caused by people who are not under their control, it could open the door, theoretically anyway, to lawsuits against car manufacturers, motorcycle manufacturers for advertising in the same way that that may encourage people to step on the throttle a little bit or gun their motorcycle down the highway. And that would open a Pandora's box that I don't think anybody in industry wants opened.
I don't know. When I see the way some people drive and compare it to what I see in the car commercials, it might not be such a bad idea.
Well, there is that perspective, of course. But getting back to the firearms issue, the plaintiffs in this case alleged that the guns were marketed in a way to appeal to 20-something types, which Adam Lanza was. But it overlooks the fact that Adam Lanza didn't buy those firearms. His mother did, Nancy Lanza. She was, I think, 50 or 51 years old when she bought those guns. She apparently enjoyed shooting and owning firearms. She bought them legally in Connecticut. That much was even explained by the New York Times. He murdered her and took those guns down to the school that morning and committed that horrible act.
Right. But in this case, I was surprised that the Supreme Court gave the go-ahead to this, because I thought that the law, in fact, did protect Remington and other companies from the misuse of their weapons.
Yeah, I think that came as a surprise to some people. I was talking to Alan Gottlieb at the Second Amendment Foundation this morning. He doesn't think that should be a big surprise, because ultimately this case is probably going to wind up back before the Supreme Court. But right now, remember that the court already has a bunch of gun cases on the table. One of them has accepted that's challenging a handgun law in New York City. And that, to me, seems like a pretty full plate of any type of case that's going to be looked at by the Supreme Court.
But then what it means is that under current law, gun manufacturers are treated like, for example, opioid manufacturers who got in trouble for the way they marketed their drugs.
Well, I don't know that we could actually say that. This is a case that the Connecticut State Supreme Court had a split ruling back in March. Connecticut's got a state statute that does allow for lawsuits against firearms manufacturers if they market their products in such a way that it might be a problem to public safety. And, you know, we're going to see how that shakes out, because you're going to have two colliding laws, one at the state level and one at the federal level, and we'll just see where this goes.
You're a big supporter of the Second Amendment, of course. If this does indeed open the way to lawsuits against manufacturers for the way they market guns, or, I mean, the implication I get from this case is that the Sandy Hook families are claiming that Remington had no right to sell anything like an AR-15, because it's simply too powerful a weapon. What would the consequences be?
Well, I think it's going to be a full employment act for every attorney out there, because there will be legal actions probably long after you and I are gone to defend the right of a firearms manufacturer to market a product that actually happens to be the most popular rifle in America today. There are millions of people who own those guns. They haven't harmed anybody. I know people who own more than one of them. That's what is so interesting, I think, about the Remington case. We've got a federal statute that's supposed to protect lawful firearms manufacturers from what is termed junk lawsuits. I don't know that this lawsuit is a junk lawsuit. That's going to be up to the court to decide. Whichever way it goes, we're going to find out whether that federal law has any teeth or whether it doesn't.
Dave Workman, senior editor at thegunmag.org. Dave, thank you.
Thank you.
We will go to the Daily Dose of Kindness. In the impeachment hearings, though, George Kent, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, is giving his opening statement, painting himself as a nonpartisan public servant, talking about his father serving in the Navy, uncles with military service. So we'll continue to monitor that for you as we go to the Daily Dose of Kindness. We aren't the only CBS affiliate highlighting the kind of kind work of others. CBS New York has a new feature called Oh My Goodness, doing stories of the good deeds done in their community. And reporter Charlie Cooper has their first story of this series.
For the Moens, most trips to the grocery store are done with their hands full of empty bottles.
I was collecting them from school.
9-year-old Abigail Moen says she started doing so after watching a commercial about children around the world with cleft palates who struggle with eating, drinking, speaking, and even smiling.
I watched it and then I got so sad because I wanted to help all those kids, so we did some research.
She started looking at the cost of surgery, the cost of medicine, blankets, and learned a lot more about Operation Smile.
It's a nonprofit that provides free surgery to children born with a tear in their lip or a gap in the roof of their mouth. Operation Smile says a child can have surgery for as little as $240.
She talked to some of her friends, and they did a presentation in front of the student council at school, and that's kind of how the movement started.
Collecting a nickel at a time for used bottles, the family says raising money is a slow and tedious process.
You know, right, 20 bottles is only a dollar.
Abigail's efforts have already helped raise money for one surgery. Her hope is to continue collecting these bottles to help support many others. The fourth grader says she wants to be a surgeon when she grows up to help more kids who have the birth defect.
If they have a smile on their face, I have a smile on my face.
With just a few dollars in her hands after recycling dozens of bottles, Abigail says it's worth the work it takes to give kids the kind of happiness she gets from doing this kind of work.
And that story from CBS New York.
This is Seattle's Morning News. What do you do if you're an adult with no friends? You hire a friend coach, apparently. Here's Rachel Bell. Says this is a true thing.
It's a true thing.
So how does it work?
Okay, so I've reported before that there are some apps out there already that are for friend-making, platonic friendships. There's Bumble BFF, which is a branch off of Bumble, which is a dating app. And then there's one called Hey Vina, which has always and only been for friend matches. But now there are all these different kind of niche apps as well. So there's Torlina, which matches solo female travelers. There's Meet My Dog, so you can hang out with other dog people. There's Rent a Friend, who you actually hire somebody to go to a movie with you or a baseball game or whatever. And then there's just a guy named Chuck McCarthy who calls himself the People Walker in LA. And hundreds of people pay him $21 for 30 minutes just to take a walk with him.
Seriously.
And it sounds like he's a great conversationalist.
Well, yeah, I would hope so for that price.
Yes.
I was just wondering if there is a generational problem here. I mean, if there's some reason why my generation sort of had our friends made for us without apps and why yours does not.
Well, I think it's two things. I think number one, the younger generation, there's a lot of people who work from home, so they don't have the chance to meet people at work, so they're kind of isolated. Right. One of the things in the article, they said, you know, people are staying single longer, so maybe they require more friendships because, you know, in your generation, you were already married, you already had this built-in companion.
That's right.
But I think the other thing is, not everyone from your generation has a bunch of friends. There is loneliness. I think that just there was nothing done about it in this way. And I mean, there's articles every day about how loneliness is just as harmful as smoking
True.
Cigarettes. And
my generation is because our friends are dying off. I mean, there's the problem. But no, it was having kids, actually, I think, where we started making friends, because you meet through your kids. And then, you know, if you get along, you keep on going.
Yeah, it seems like there's also a lot more anxiety in general now. You hear about people, you know, there's always been shy people, but I think that's right. Amped up. So maybe people have a harder time making friends. Some people are spending a lot of money to make friends. There is this matchmaker named Michelle Jacoby in Washington, D.C. On her website, it said she won Matchmaker of the Year in 2018. There are prizes for this, apparently. And she charges between $750 and $2,100. And she acts like, you know, a matchmaker, like an old school matchmaker.
Is that for one friend?
Well, the cheapest package will get you 3 introductions in 3 months. So not much. And that's for $720. That's the special right now. It's usually $900. And so just kind of like the old school matchmaker. She meets you in person. You fill out this questionnaire. The whole point is that when she meets someone, she can say, oh, when I met this woman, I think that you would be perfect for her. Let me set you up. So her thing is also sending people on activities, not just going to sit and have coffee and talk, because she thinks that that is more of a bonding experience and it can build trust. And you can,
like, hot coals and rope courses and things like that.
Yes. You know, trust falls and telling each other your darkest, most intimate secrets.
Hmm.
I don't know. They were doing a ropes course in this article.
Just join a community acting group.
Everybody should.
Yeah.
Cool solution.
Well, because then,
Dave likes acting. Everyone should like acting.
No, you don't have to like acting or not, but the exercises they do, they include the trust falls and also, you know, let's be an elephant today. You know, all that sort of stuff where you let your hair hang down and sometimes you get to know a sane person.
I just hope that there isn't so much of a stigma, because I think a lot of people read this and go, how desperate do you have to be to pay this money? Well, the same stigma existed when online dating started.
Sure.
And now that's gone.
I'm a big believer in that, since the reason I have two sons-in-law is because of online dating.
And they didn't even have to go to an acting class to meet these men.
Well, sort of, but that's another matter.
But I think people are embarrassed, and I understand why. I think it's embarrassing to have to say out loud, I don't have that many friends, or I don't have friends. And like, you go out to try to meet people and it's like, well, how do you meet someone if you don't really have any friends? You need a base group.
Don't you think part of the reason is you don't need friends anymore? Because as long as you have your smartphone, everything's at your fingertips right there.
That's a good point.
Right from the airport.
Well, I don't know why you didn't become a therapist. You have so many great thoughts and pieces of advice.
Yeah, they're all negative.
I know.
Dave, how to make friends. You don't need to make friends.
You don't need
Just
friends.
Just use your smartphone. Thank you for making my day, Rachel.
You're welcome. Thank you, therapist.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.